History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And really, they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to take a little initiative and ask a few questions, and then being willing to patiently listen as memories from long ago start to return to the forefront again. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This weekend marks the 80th anniversary of the Bataan Death March, one of World War II's most infamous incidents. We've heard from several survivors of the march over the years here on Hometown Heroes, and we're going to make that the focus of our program next time, perhaps with a highlight or two from commemorations taking place this week around the country and around the world. But I promise that this time we would conclude the story of Duane Harvey from the 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment. Mr. Harvey has spent the last couple decades in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and he is a voracious reader and student of history, so surely he could tell you quite a bit about the Bataan Death March and the fact that New Mexico had more men on that tragic march than any other state. While he did not witness any of that firsthand, he did survive another of World War II's deadliest situations, the Battle of the Bulge, and specifically the Siege of Bastogne. The 501st was awarded a Presidential Unit Citation for its performance there, surrounded by enemy forces, suffering nearly 600 casualties in the regiment, but holding its ground and helping the Allies thwart Hitler's last real chance at victory in Europe. There's quite a bit more to Mr. Harvey's story, so we took that rare step of extending this conversation to a second episode. If you missed the first part of his story last time, you can access that and all past episodes at hometownheroesradio.com. Mr. Harvey provided some poignant perspective on the seemingly arbitrary nature of casualties in war, illustrated by two men from his regiment who paid the ultimate price. I'm going to share just a brief excerpt of what he shared last week to prepare you for the rest of the story today. The 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment was the first element of the 101st Airborne Division to encounter the enemy during the Battle of the Bulge.
Strung them out in a line in the snow, and I told the first kid where the firefight was going on up ahead. I said, "Now you watch that man right there. And when he moves forward, you move forward. When he stops, you stop." So then I went back to each one of those kids and told them, I said, "You watch the boy in front of you, and you follow him." And then I got back so I wouldn't be leaving him behind. So this was in the snow and the woods and the trees and all the firing. Pretty soon the first kid come running back and yelling, "They're gone, they're gone, he's gone. He's gone." And I thought, oh, hell, because there was in there, got these six kids, got to join up with the others, and they're not going to know whether we're Germans or Americans. So went up and started yelling that we was coming in, we was Americans, friends, on, and we was coming into where they were. So I got them back in. We were coming back because it was morning. I come across the foxhole and took out three Germans out of the foxhole who'd knuckled down underneath there and stayed and let us go on by them, and was still there when we were coming back. So then I coming over, and they were carrying an American back. So I took the Germans and said, "We'll take him." So three prisoners I had, well, we carried the fella back across the river, the bridge, and when I got him to the first aid station, medic looked at him, says he's dead. So I took my prisoners, turned them back into the prisoner cage, and went back to headquarters. And when I got back there, they says, "Hurry up, we got a stand inspection." So what stand inspection? And Captain Howard came by, and he grabbed my rifle and looked at it and says, "It's dirty." I said, "Well, I was on the raid last night." So he knew he had made a mistake and gave him a rifle back, but went on down the line. I never did like the Captain Howard. A number of years later, I was living in Wichita on the fellow called me, who was a sergeant in charge of the medics. He was in Wichita, and we pick up his daughter. We were talking about things, and I told him about carrying the wounded man back on the plank board that we'd picked up. And he says, they brought Gulick back on a board. So I learned that it was Gulick. Well, then I found out Gulick had jumped in Normandy. He had fought in Holland. He had fought in Bastogne. He was in Alsace. And when he got hit and was killed, that was the last battle combat we were in. So he had, from Normandy to the last hour, if he'd got through that night, why, maybe Gulick's still around. So I remember those two, Don Fair and Gulick, one who was killed the first time he was in combat with no experience, and then Gulick, who was killed the very last hour.
And I could tell you've given that some thought over the years, and I guess my follow-up would be, is there something that you draw from that? That contrast that you painted, the differing circumstances or the different experience leading up to their death, but the fact that they were both two who paid that ultimate price. What do you take away from what you just told me?
Well, here is one boy in high school and the war. He didn't survive there one bit of it. So what would his life have been? And here was Gulick, who did all this combat and was killed at the end of his fighting career. What would his life have been? I know what mine has been, but what would theirs have been?
That is the question, isn't it? And how many of us wouldn't be here if our parents or grandparents had not survived World War II? I want you to hear the rest of Mr. Harvey's story now. We left off last time with him explaining that he spent Christmas Eve, Christmas, and his 20th birthday on December 26, 1944, protecting Allied officers holed up at the Chateau Ile-la-Hesse. So I'm just wondering, because you've had a lot of Christmases since that, 77 Christmases since that. Are there some things that you saw or experienced that Christmas that come back to mind sometimes when Christmas comes around?
No. Just there in the upstairs room, and we had to enter through the back door because that was the servant's entrance, and that's what we used. And so that was, we were inside a building. We were no longer outside. We were back behind the line, so we were, let's say, safe back there. You know, wouldn't have any machine gun, rifle fire, mortar fire. You could have shell fire, yes. But no, you got back. Why? Yeah, that was a safe place.
And just so I understand, I think what you're saying is the purpose of your being there was to protect the top brass that were holed up there.
Yes.
And that was Christmas, but the next day's your 20th birthday. What was that like?
Just the same as the day before and the day after.
I had a feeling you'd say that.
It wasn't any different. You're talking about religion. And I always said I was considerably older for I realize whose birthday they were celebrating at Christmas.
Well, and you didn't get to celebrate yours either, it sounds like. What about, I mean, I don't want to skip over anything that's important to you. But as, you know, days and days go by, and finally this tide is turned, and was there a moment where you realized that you guys weren't cut off anymore, that you weren't going to be stuck there, and that it wasn't going to end the way so many feared it would?
Well, as I say, when we were leaving and stuck there, why, previously we were on the defense. And when you're on your defense, why, you're in your foxhole, you're in this, you're in a safe place. When they're relieved, and we were in what was called the Bojack Woods, and on the offensive, and the fighting in the woods, then you're up out of that hole, and you're going into the fire. You're not there. So that was the difference in being surrounded and being relieved, is then's when we really got to casualties.
You're a lot more exposed in that position. And can you give us a feel for what that's like as you tried to advance? I mean, I'm just thinking about being in the woods. Fire of multiple kinds can be coming from anywhere.
I think that when you, just like when you've been back in reserve and you go up to relieve people on the line, you're back behind. Now, you're still in a danger area, but you're known rifle fire. Then as you march up, I think you get a little bit of a feel of apprehension because you know you're coming into a different situation each time, and the situation is closing as you get nearer and nearer and nearer till you leave that man in his foxhole so he can go back and you take over his foxhole. So you become apprehensive.
And, I mean, some of this may seem obvious for you, but, again, most people haven't lived through what you lived through. So I'm just curious. You mentioned rifle fire. That's one of the things that can happen to you. What are some of the other things that you had to, you know, be prepared for?
Well, you got mortar fire. You got artillery fire. Well, you can always, you hear the artillery coming. Mortar, you can hear a kind of a whir, but then it's bang. You know, there was a difference between an 88 and a 75. So these are sounds that you get used to, that you recognize that they're a dangerous sound.
So if you heard an 88, what would you do?
Well, it all depends on where you were, what's there. You reacted a different way. If you was in the foxhole, why, and you got to the bottom of it. If you was out in the open, you get to tell whether it's going over or not. And if it's coming close, why, you're going to hit the ground. And that's one of the things that people always in combat is what you call a short round. That round that it sounds like it's going over, and it doesn't. It hits.
It all sounds like a nightmare, I think, to most of us. And I'm just curious about something else there, because you talked about being in amongst the trees. Was the tree burst phenomenon something that you witnessed or had to watch out for?
Oh, you say witness, it's, yeah, the one when you're in that. But there again, you say witness. There's no witness to it. It... because it's coming through, and it's not at the end of its on.
And you did say, too, that, you know, it was after you went on the offensive that the casualties started to pile up. So I'm assuming that you're seeing these casualties. Some of these guys might have been pretty close to you.
All right. Now, I was in the S2 squad. The S2 squad's duties was to man the observation post and on. And the other thing was to take charge of the POWs. So let's say for a lot of it, we trailed along behind. So here was the squad up here, and then we were back here. And so let's say that they were doing the fighting, we were trailing along behind. So there again, I was, let's say, fortunate most of the time that... my duties were a little different from the rifleman, although I was a rifleman in the S2 squad. Their job was a little different than what mine was.
I don't know if this is an easy question to answer, but you've handled every question so far, so why not? Is there something that you look back on and you say, this was the most challenging aspect of what I did in World War II? Something that was the most difficult for you to deal with?
Nothing I recall.
Nothing fazed you?
No. I was, let's say, I was growing up. The one thing, when I got discharged, I had just turned 21, and I was coming through the separation center, which was also an induction center, because they were still drafting 18-year-olds. Here I come through, and I looked, and I thought, my goodness, these are kids. I didn't think of myself as a kid when I was 18 and going into the service. But yet, when I looked at them, I thought, yeah, they're kids.
Anything that I don't ask you about that you think is important, feel free to add in there. But there's all these things that we know that happened in World War II. Then there's a lot of things that could have happened and almost happened that we don't always hear about. And am I understanding correctly that you guys, before VE Day, were preparing to potentially make a combat jump to try to liberate some of the prisoner of war camps where Americans and Brits were held by the Germans?
They were afraid, the upper brass, was that the Germans would start to annihilate POWs, or that they would try to move them, and they would be in no physical condition to be moved. So they assigned, kept us back to, if they got rumors or evidence that this was going to happen, why, we would jump and protect them on. And so we, the 501 of the 101st, and then there was another regiment, I think the 82nd, were on alert. We were both up near Reims. While we were there on this alert, there was a group of soldiers who came in to our headquarters company, and they ate in our mess, but they kept separate from us. They kept by themselves, and they were radio men who were there to be contacted in case, you know, they'd contact them.
Those radio guys would be coordinating or passing along information if you had to deploy that way.
Yes.
And how did you feel about that possibility of jumping into a heavily defended POW camp?
Well, we didn't know. They it was just a job. Yeah.
I'm just thinking of a lot of the POWs who I've talked to. And at that point, you know, some of them had only been there a few weeks. Others had been there for months. A lot of them are starving. They're losing weight. They've seen guys shot by the guards. They've seen people try to escape and be executed as a result. And they didn't know what was going on. And it was so desperate for them. I'm just imagining what it would have meant to them if you guys risked your own lives to set them free. Did you have any idea what POWs had been going through over there?
Oh, no. No, there was no. Now an aside.
Yeah.
Did you know about Patton's son-in-law?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a story by itself. He sacrificed a battalion.
That is a whole story of its own, and we've heard some of that story on Hometown Heroes. If you have the time and you want to hear that story, head over to hometownheroesradio.com and pull up episode number 354, and you can learn about General Patton's son-in-law, John K. Waters, from Alan Dunbar, who told us Waters saved his life in Stalag 7A. There's much more to come in this episode with 97-year-old Dwayne Harvey of Albuquerque, New Mexico, including what it was like to march through New York City in the Victory Parade when he came home from World War II. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Pro proudly presented by Provident Payments. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 97-year-old Dwayne Harvey of Albuquerque, New Mexico, originally from Henrietta, Oklahoma, and one of the last surviving members of the 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment from World War II, an outfit recognized with the Presidential Unit Citation for its heroics during the Battle of the Bulge. When we left off, Mr. Harvey had shared how toward the end of the war in Europe, when most of the 101st Airborne was sent to the Ruhr Pocket to help root out remaining German forces, the 501st was held back to prepare for a combat jump with the intent of liberating Allied prisoners from German POW camps. I guess that makes me think, too. If word had come that the enemy was going to start executing some of those prisoners. I guess that makes me think, too. Because there are all these POW camps throughout German-occupied territory, and some people sometimes get those confused with the other camps, the concentration camps. Were you at all aware during this time of those concentration camps or what Hitler was doing?
No. Oh, when after the surrendered, here was all what we call the DPs, the dispossessed people, wandering all over Europe. You couldn't help but know that they had been in the, not necessarily called concentration camps, but they were in camps, and it was displaced people from all these different countries had been transported back to Germany.
And you saw some of them?
Oh, everybody saw them because they were everywhere. Yeah, and they talk about the insecticide, DDT, and here they had that, and they pulled up the shirt, and ends up, and they scored them all with DDT.
You mentioned the surrender. Do you have a memory of VE Day and what that meant for you and the guys with you?
No, because there again, we were on the alert to jump. So we were on a combat status all that end of the there to, on. And, of course, there was the false VE Day. But no, to us, it was still combat.
Well, tell me about the false VE Day.
Well, there where one day they said it was victory and the war was over, and it was a false report, and it was still going on, and it was a week or two later that the actual fighting stopped.
No. That's what I wanted to clarify. So when it finally was over, when Germany did surrender on May the 8th of 1945, did that change anything for you after that?
No, we was in France, and the division was in Bavaria, you know, at Bircher's Garden.
Yeah.
So we then went down and joined the division and became part of the occupation, so we were spread out.
Did you get to go see the eagle's nest there that they were hanging out at?
Bircher's Garden, yes, but wasn't up into the eagle's nest, but there was the barracks, you know, down below and where they were.
And I'm just thinking about some of the things that you've shared. You know, you talked about the young man who was killed on that very first day, and then the other one, Gulick, who you carried all this way to try to save him, and you find out he was dead. Then you get to the end of this war, and Germany's surrendered. The fact that you guys prevailed against that enemy, knowing some of those who had given their lives, was that meaningful to you?
No. Somewhere along there, we were slated for the invasion of Japan. So for us, the war wasn't over. We were going to, it was just an interval till we were going to be fighting in Japan.
So you're there in Germany, but they're telling you, get ready, and you haven't made a combat jump yet, and you're thinking, I'm going to have to jump behind enemy lines in Japan?
Not then, but that was just being a paratrooper. That was going to be part of it.
I know hypotheticals are really hard, you know. It's who knows what would have happened. But have you ever thought about it? What would have happened if you had to jump into Japan?
No, because that ended, you know, before we left while we were still overseas, still in Europe. And by then, we knew.
When I had the privilege of shaking your hand here, you handed me something. It's a picture of a young paratrooper, and you told me what the occasion was that picture was taken. And there aren't too many people around who were part of this, but When you came back to the States, you were part of something significant.
Well, I didn't know then we were going to be in this. They initiated the point system for discharge, and the 501st was never an integral part of the 101st Airborne Division. It was attached. It was not assigned, although all the combat experience and everything was with the 101st. So they started discharging troops. And there again, I was sent to a glider battalion, the 81st AAAT battalion. Now, that was one disappointment because I thought, well, I'll get to make a glider flight. And that didn't happen. But there was one aspect of my career that changed. Paratroopers were egotistical. And as I said, we thought we were different and on. And the glidermen, if they were men, they would volunteer for the paratroopers instead of riding a glider. The glidermen did not volunteer. The Army took the attitude, we can put you in a truck, we can put you in a glider. But the battalion I was in, the battery was equipped with 50 caliber for anti-aircraft event. But they didn't have any use for them as anti-aircraft, so they sent them up on the lines with the infantry and with the paratroopers. So there was where I learned, well, here, the battery I'm in had been up on the line with the paratroopers, and they're fighting. Only we're getting $50 extra a month. They're getting nothing. So then they changed that and then started paying the gliders $50. But that was one aspect. But there again, we thought we were different. And I think we were.
And on the flip side of that, because I've talked to some of those guys too, I mean, there were some parallels. They could only go one way too. There was no going back. I mean, that glider was going to land behind enemy lines, and they were going to have to fight their way out of there just like you guys would.
Yeah. Then they deactivated the 17th Airborne Division overseas. They split them up and sent part of them to the 82nd and the 101st. Have you ever heard of the 1st Special Service Forces?
Yeah, the Red Devils?
Yeah, which was British and the American unit on, which they deactivated them because of the differences between the cultures. So we got some of the 1st Special Service. They spread them out between the divisions. Then, while they were still overseas, they had deactivated the 17th, assigned them to the 82nd and the 101st. Then they deactivated the 101st overseas, and they transferred all of us into the 82nd. So the 82nd Division, which marched in the victory parade, was actually three units of 101st, the 17th, the 82nd, and a few 1st Special Service, probably.
So you mean to tell me that you're a Screaming Eagle who's also an All-American?
Yes, but have no allegiance or anything to the 82nd.
Some folks are aware there is a little bit of a rivalry there. But so tell me about this, because you mentioned the victory parade. You marched in this victory parade in New York City. But coming home, coming back to America, here you've been overseas, risking your life. You've seen your fellow soldiers, your fellow paratroopers killed, wounded. You're coming back in one piece, physically. I don't know how you felt mentally or emotionally, but what was that like, coming back home to the U.S.?
We came back on the Queen Mary. There again, it was a troop ship, and we was all there. The only thing was we didn't worry anything about submarines. You were still in the Army. You were still under that discipline. You were still under that routine. So you didn't know when you was getting out. You were still in the Army.
And this victory parade, what do you remember about that? What was it like to be one of those guys who got to march in what was a real symbolic event for the country?
Well, there again, We got up, we had breakfast, and I don't remember which I, you know, how I got from Camp Shakes down to the Battery, you know, lower part of Manhattan. We formed up, it was in companies, and took a position and marched up Fifth Avenue and to the end and went over and got back on the trains and went back to Camp Shanks. So really to us, it was nothing. We knew he was marching up the Victory Parade, but there he was still, he's in your unit, your platoon. There was this fellow over here who had been there at breakfast time and previous there and was there after. So,
but that wasn't an empty Fifth Avenue. There were a lot of people lining both sides of it to cheer you on as you marched. Did that make an impression on you?
No, there again, depend all where you were in the ranks, because you could be here in the middle of the company, and you couldn't see really down here, people over here, but there again, you were marching as a unit. It wasn't that big of a deal at that time. The band was way up front, and yeah, as I said, to us, it was a hike.
And then you end up getting discharged from the Army. And I'm just wondering if you can put it in perspective for me, the difference between that 18-year-old who got drafted out of Henrietta, Oklahoma, and the 21-year-old wearing a combat infantry badge when he came back home.
Well, when I got back home, there wasn't that many people there in my hometown that I had, you know, went to school with or kids, because a lot of those had got back, gone to school, enrolled in college. I'd gotten back a little late. My brother was going to school at Kansas University, so I went up to visit him, and they was just starting to enroll there, so I enrolled in college. There again, in the 30s, and when I was in high school, there wasn't that many children or kids in high school that would be going on to college. Let's say it was the well-to-do people, the children of the well-to-do people. That was something unusual at that time. When I went, started to KU, there was maybe only a couple of thousand students there. Now, that's the big difference. And all of that's a result of the GI Bill.
And that was my next question. You beat me to the punch. It sounds like the GI Bill made a pretty big difference in your life.
Oh, that affected everybody's life. That was the big thing. It was the GI Bill in all of the soldiers' lives.
And is that where you met your wife, at KU?
Yes.
Good thing you made it home, I guess, huh?
Yes. Now, there's one aspect of this thing that I've often thought about. When I was in the Bulge, I was separated from when I went out to that roadblock. Then I'd hooked up with a glider company for a couple of weeks. But word got back to my unit that I'd been wounded. So my mother received a telegram saying I'd been wounded in action and further information would come from the hospital. It was almost a month till she got another telegram saying it was a mistake that I had not been wounded. But I've often thought, well, there was my mother that said, here your baby boy has been wounded and is in a hospital, but had no idea how serious or how anything else. So what was her thoughts during that month? Now, I've often wondered about that. But I never knew she had received those telegrams until 60, 70 years later.
So she wasn't around to answer that question anymore. And what'd you get your degree in?
I didn't get a degree. I had extra hours, but my last semester and on there when I was a senior, why, they come up and they said, you need 2 hours of biology. And that was a freshman course. They enrolled me in insects and man biology, entomology course, which was a biology. There it wasn't entomology, it was biology. Well, when I got to the class, it was medical entomology. Well, at that time I was married and had a baby in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So I got an F in that course because I was hitchhiking to Tulsa and back. And then Sunday, I'd hitchhike back. I had also enrolled in the advanced ROTC because I got a little money. So I was head of the ROTC unit there because I'd been to cadre school and I had all the experience and everything. So when the semester was over, sergeant in charge of the ROTC called me down. He was a state in, an old hand. He said, "Do you want this commission or not?" And I said, "Oh, I guess so." Well, he says, "I'll make an appointment for you to take a physical up at Fort Leavenworth tomorrow morning." I hitchhiked to Fort Leavenworth, took my physical, and he says, "Sign these papers. I'll fill them out later on." So I signed all the papers, and he took over. So I hitchhiked to Fort Leavenworth, took the physical, and hitchhiked to Tulsa and got a job. And Korea broke out. A couple of weeks later, I ran into a kid there on the streets of Tulsa who would in ROTC with me. And he says, "What are you doing here?" I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "We've all been called up." I said, "I haven't heard anything from them." Well, because I'd flunked that course, why then I needed that two-hour course in order to get a degree, which would have been in geology. So I didn't get a degree. I didn't get commissioned because I wasn't a graduate. So that changed my life because I thought as a infantry second lieutenant, I would have been in Korea, boom. What would I have done then? That would have affected my life. But that didn't happen. So
not that we're advising this to any students today, but it sounds like you're saying that getting an F may have saved your life.
Yes. Well, second lieutenants didn't last very long in the infantry. And with combat experience, yeah. Now, I would have volunteered for the paratroops, for sure. And I'd have asked to have been assigned to the 82nd, because that was the other, along with the 11th. Which was in Asia, but no.
What a fragile balance. So many twists of fate evident throughout Mr. Harvey's story, but we're not done yet. Every veteran's story is unique, and we're going to hear more of how he really feels when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business, and if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton, with experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website, that's simple, cvtr.com. For Central Valley Trailer Repair, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, wrapping up a second episode now with the remarkable Dwayne Harvey, 97 years young and going strong in Albuquerque, New Mexico. By now you know he served with the 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment in World War II, Headquarters Company 1st Battalion, to be specific. Well, I don't want to leave out anything that's important to you. I do have a couple more questions, but I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for telling us this story. Thank you for serving our country. And I think we're all amazed at how sharp your memory is and how well you explain the things that you went through. I'm looking at your hat here. It's got that Screaming Eagle right on the front, and it said 101st Airborne on it. What does that mean to you? What does that represent? How do you feel about being a Screaming Eagle?
Well, I think of myself as being a 501st paratrooper. The 501st regiment had regimental reunions for a good many years. My wife and I used to go to the reunions every year. So there was where I kept my connections, was with the 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment. When I first started going, the squad, there'd be a table, and there'd be a squad I was in. As the years went by, it dwelled down to where then the platoon occupied the table. Then it was a company occupying a table. Then a battalion occupying a table. Then it was down to where just the regiment. And then in 2016, I was the sole trooper there. Now, there are still troopers left at that time, and that was June the 6th and everything. And so some of the veterans had gone to Normandy, but that was the last one. So there was where that I picked up at one of there. But so I identify with the 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment, more than the 101st. And since it was always attached and not assigned.
You mentioned Normandy, and I know the you've been awarded medals from the governments of Belgium, of the Netherlands, most recently France gave you their Legion of Honor. Have you been back to those countries to see the difference that you and all your fellow paratroopers and fellow soldiers made?
I have traveled overseas a lot. Ireland, Wales, Scotland, England, Holland, Belgium, France, Germany, Austria, Italy, Turkey, Morocco, Spain, Portugal, Egypt, the old USSR, all of there, Finland, Russia, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Georgia, all of them there, China, Australia. So I've traveled a lot overseas, but I never went back to any of those places.
The places where you fought?
That's right, fought. I've never had any real desire to go back.
Is that because you think it would be too difficult to be there again?
No, just have no desire. Okay. The same way as places here in the United States. I've been by Fort Sill, but there wouldn't have been anything there. It was there that I'd recognize to see and say, well, I've been there. You asked about my siblings.
Yeah.
Now, my brother is buried at Arlington. My sister's buried at Arlington. I have a nephew buried at Arlington. I have a brother-in-law buried there and on. So I have been to Arlington a number of times. Just recently, there was a fellow here in the park. There's some organizations, you know, that sponsors a trip back to Arlington. He's a Vietnam veteran. But now, that was something very special to him, to go back there and see the memorials and the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier and all this. Well, I have no desire. I think go down and say, here, I'm eligible, and I'd pay my expense, whole trip, everything back there. But I've been there. I've seen it.
Well, have you seen the National World War II Memorial?
Oh, yes.
At that memorial, you got 4,000 gold stars there, representing 400,000 of your contemporaries who didn't come home like you did. I know a lot of these questions I'm asking you, I'm assuming there's some feeling or emotion there that you just don't experience in some of those situations. But in that situation, looking at that wall of gold stars, was there something that reality stirred in you?
No, because that's what I expect. Yeah, there's people there that I know, I say I know, that is in a foxhole, shell hit, cover them up, they're missing. Yeah, there's there. So there's those people. Well, that was just part of my experience in the war. And so these gold stars, there were these people that I saw. When we was in Alsace, The snow, the warm weather came, snow melted, and here uncovered all these bodies. Members of the 42nd Division who had been fighting the Germans there during the Alsace campaign, and snow covered them up, and there they are. They're carrying them out, laying them aside the road to be picked up. Been laying there all winter, flattened, just part of my life. So, as you say, here's these stars. They're just representing these people.
How do you think those people need to be remembered all these years later?
I think they've been forgotten. So they can put something there. People go and they look. Well, they see, well, here's all these gold stars. It's a different thought to them. But I think they don't really, they're just gold stars. They're not a person.
Is there something you would prescribe or recommend that you think would ensure that they're not forgotten, that their sacrifice is not forgotten? Is there something we can do to recognize that?
No. What's it? You can say, that's World War II, but what about World War I? What about Spanish American? When I was in high school, when it come to Memorial Day, there was two gentlemen up on the stage, one of them in a gray uniform, one of them in a blue uniform, the father of both of them, their grandfather. But they're Civil War veterans. To me, I knew Civil War veterans. But now, what does a Civil War veteran mean to you or anything? That's something, just past history.
Well, you know, the reason I do this and other people do these kinds of things is that hopefully we won't forget, that we won't forget the price that was paid for our freedom. And you were part of that price because you endured 3 years in the Army in World War II. If there's anything else you want to add, please feel free. But there is one other question that I'm very interested in the answer to, because you've been on this planet for 97 and a half years now, and people can hear how full of life you are. Is there something, when you think back over all those years, that you would say personally you're most proud of?
Well, I have pride in my life. Well, I'm proud of my life.
Is there something you'd say you're most thankful for?
That I've lived to be 97 years old. And I realized that if I go down to, like Walmart, they had benches set up by the checkout stands, and I see these people walk by. I feel very fortunate that I can get up off that bench and walk out. And when I see them in wheelchairs, using canes and on, and obviously much younger than I am.
What's your secret? What do you think explains the kind of shape you're in?
Well, I get up in the morning, and I'm going to have an excellent day. So I have an excellent day. The other thing is that I hear people, they start talking old, they start acting old, and they get old. Now, I go to coffee, I hear them talking, as I say to myself, and I listen to the stories, and their stories are different than what I would remember them, and I can say, you're thinking wrong.
Well, you've been very generous with your time, sir. Thanks so much. Is there anything I didn't ask you about that you think we ought to know?
Oh, we could probably talk forever, but...
Well, here's one more. Is there anything that you haven't done or experienced in 97 plus years that you're still looking forward to?
Well, I've traveled a lot. There's a lot of places that I haven't traveled that I know I'll never see. They're all over the world. They're in the United States, in Albuquerque. I know that there's these places I'll never see. I would like to see all those places. I read a lot. I see something. Now, you know the Moldau River? Smetana wrote the Moldau, and that's a musical piece. Well, I got on the computer. I read about the Moldau River, but I'm no one ever going to see it. But I would like to see it. I guess maybe I've got an inquisitive mind. They see in the Ukraine the fighting going on there and about Kiev. I heard about the Great Gate of Kiev. So I got a book, whatnot, and I looked to read about the Great Gate of Kiev. Run across the fellow that had just come back from Kiev. This is a number of years ago. I asked him about the Great Gate of Kiev. That I didn't know that much about it, but I knew that it was there. Well, it had never been built. So that's when I got up to read about the Great Gate of Kiev, then had to listen to Mussorgsky's musical version of it.
Well, we can all listen to just a few bars of that as we bring this fascinating conversation to a close. And maybe the whole saga of the Great Gate of Kiev is something you feel like researching yourself. You can follow the lead of this 97-year-old whose inquisitive mind and desire to learn are as strong as ever. Don't forget, if you missed the first part of our interview with Mr. Harvey, you can access that episode online at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you can join us again next time when we'll be reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.
Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest. Did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful, and I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car. And here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma because you can check out their wall of honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. You can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit. And don't leave without visiting that wall of honor.